Welcome to the Rodcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rod. So my guest today needs no introduction. However, I will read some of his accomplishments just because they're so incredible. He established the Center for Epidemiological Research at the South African Medical Research Council. He was the executive director of WHO and the person who spearheaded the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. He later became a professor in public health and headed the Division of Global Health at Yale University. He was the senior vice president for PepsiCo, chief health officer for Vitality, and the president of the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. He's sat on numerous boards within the Lancet Commission for Planetary Health, the World Economic Forum, among others, and has authored over 250 articles. He's been cited in the New York Times, the Huffington Post, the Guardian, the Economist. It's my great pleasure today to welcome, I would say, global health royalty, Derek Yak. Welcome to the Rodcast.
Well, it's such a privilege to be here, and I've never been called royalty before, but I am a fan of the British royalty, so I'll accept that.
There's so many things I want to ask you about, but I thought maybe we'd start with the first time I became familiar with your work. I think I mentioned briefly the other day we had lunch together, but it was when I was working at WHO at the Department of Health System Strengthening, and one of the executive assistants had been your executive assistant, and she told me the wildest story that has been in my head for years, and I couldn't quite put my finger on, you know, whether it was true or not. And so what better way to start us off? But basically, she told me a story where you had successfully built the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, put all the elements in place. It was a done deal, and your next, you know, big challenge was taking on food, which of course was, you know, sugar, fat, salt, and you'd gathered all the evidence from, you know, from the science, from the literature, and you had raised some red flags within these industries, especially in the US, which had then in turn lobbied a few politicians. It had managed to get all the way to the top, and you were essentially asked to put the brakes on because the implications that these recommendations would have on the sale of these products would be massive. And so, being the maverick that you are, you said, I don't care, I'm going to go forward with it. I'm going to do this in the name of global health. And you went from having a team of three executives, 250 staff, a desk overseeing an amazing view of Lake Geneva, to then being downgraded to a much smaller office and one staff.
Well, it's sort of a mixture of things. It is true that we did start what was then called a boring report called 916, a World Health Organization Food and Agriculture Organization review of dietary guidelines. And this was a scientific process to look at what should we eat more of, what should we eat less of, nothing particularly exciting. But to do it, we got the best people in the world, as you do at WHO. And I had my colleague, Ricardo Wawi, chair the thing. And the report came out, which basically said we should have less salt, less sugar, less fat. We should have more nuts, grains, and beans, and a whole lot of things. Things today we regard as pretty obvious. 20 years ago, though, I didn't realize it would unite the entire food industry against us and WHO on any topic we said you should eat less of. So the sugar industry, the beverage industry, the Sugar Growers Association, the Salt Institute, the processed meat industry, the Cattlemen's Association, which I'd never heard of, the palm industry, and so it went on. The tragedy I always felt was that the things we said you should eat more of, beans, nuts, grains, fruits, and vegetables, their industries were very quiet. They didn't come out going, yay, let's go for it. The result was that the most serious result was that the U.S. government, led by a Democrat and a Republican senator, wrote a note to WHO formally saying that they would consider withdrawing $400 million if we went ahead with the sugar recommendation, which was really then regarded as fairly radical, a decline in how much added sugars you can take. And they backed it by a report by the CDC, the FDA, the NIH, all saying we got the science wrong. My boss at the time, Brundtland, Gro Harlem Brundtland, the director general, said, you stick with the science and I'll stick with you. And that's what we did. There were letters in the New York Times. There was a lot of pressure and so on. But in the end, the report came out with a recommendation. And by the way, those recommendations are now regarded as standard across the U.S. and most parts of the world. So they were just ahead of their time. But in the aftermath of that, she resigned. And I was now left, and I actually also had to resign because all of her cabinet handed in their resignation when the director general resigned. And the question was, what would I be put onto next? And I realized I wouldn't be there for very long. As a holding operation, I was stuck in this little room, which I called the holding room. It was sort of the exit chamber because everybody went in there and ended up leaving the organization. And yes, it's true, Virgie and one colleague, an amazing woman, worked, and we basically put our head down and decided to do a major report on the future of chronic diseases.
By the way, not too shabby of a person to have on your team, Karina Hawkes.
Karina, exactly. I mean, Karina was stellar, and she was at the start of what became an even more stellar career. One of these great people who the one thing I've always tried to do is to identify talent early. She was spectacular, way beyond anything I could do. And she could do the analyses before we had AI-driven capabilities of the entire world literature on regulations on salt or sugar or fat overnight, and then produce a coherent report. And as you know, she went on to do great things in the UK food scene. So yes, partly true, but I think the lesson from it was that when WHO sticks to their guns and sticks to the science, it's at its best. When it succumbs to pressure, which I suspect it has in recent years, you lose all capability of where you should go in the public interest. And yes, some people may suffer. I don't really think I suffered enormously because I knew when Brundtland left, I would be looking to leave WHO and eventually went to Yale.
That's a great segue to another thing I wanted to ask you. I guess unlike other extremely prominent figures in global health, your time spent as a full-time individual in academia is probably shorter than most of these individuals. And I really wanted to understand why that was the case. And it reminded me of a recent conversation I had with a colleague that has been in private sector for many years, has recently moved into academia, and has really found it difficult to navigate the power struggles within the sector. So I wanted to, you know, hear what your experience was. I mean, did you have similar challenges?
I'd say partly. I mean, I have mixed views of academia. On the one hand, I have the deepest respect for my academic colleagues, and thank God we've got strong academic institutions to have people who spend their careers on a topic and become true deep experts. The cost of that is that they often are not part of the immediate action in the real world, and that is an issue. I always remember seeing one of the most complex parts. When I joined Yale, the dean said to me, okay, your first task is to integrate global health across Yale and all the activities. He wanted an integrated plan, which sounded kind of logical until I realized nobody wanted to be integrated. And that by even asking people to work together, you needed to understand the financial motivations and the personal motivations were very different in different parts of the campus. So in the medical schools, and this is true across the US and the schools of public health, they are actually based on soft money. So the faculty have to raise money, usually through the NIH and research, both to keep their posts, their faculty, to grow their tenure, to improve their position. And that does put a lot of pressure on the kind of work they do, the type of interaction they have. And that's where you get into a lot of this conflict. On the main campus, though, in the college, in the Yale College and the rest of the campus, the motivation is very different. When you get tenure, you're fully covered. And their motivation to engage in research and science is driven by, is this a really exciting project I want to devote my time on, and not the money? And I try to see how you could straddle the best of both, because they both have advantages and disadvantages. But it is true, you can get into endless cycles of meetings and reports and promotional committees and things which actually take away from the science. And that's why I think some of the top academics tend to stand back from all of that and get on with their, put their heads down and do their academic work. Having said that, I think we had a very interesting time, because I see whether it's Yale or Harvard, and I do work with Cornell Tech, which is a mixture of Cornell and the Technion. We're seeing a lot more entrepreneurial spirit coming onto the campus. So for example, to get a master's or a PhD at Cornell Tech, you need to not only have a thesis, but you need to have a business plan. And that is getting people to engage with the entrepreneurial, the business world, as well as to be the cutting edge in their own areas of academia. And the downsides to it. So I'd say it's a bit of a mixed bag. I thought you were going to ask the question actually about WHO in the private sector, because I had this famous question asked to me by Margaret Chan, who was the director general of WHO at the time. In a public meeting, somebody said to her, what's the difference between working at WHO and the private sector? And she said, she doesn't know, but there's somebody in the audience who does know, because he's been at PepsiCo. So Derek, just tell us, what's the difference? And my answer was that the talk to action ratio is the fundamental difference.
Wow, that is a very good way of putting it. Very true. And I wanted to follow up on one of the points you mentioned. I've struggled for a number of years now with conceptualizing how the chronic disease or non-communicable disease movement can really be more successful moving forward. Because my experience has been that historically you go to, you know, meetings and everyone's at the same parade but holding a completely different flag. So you have the folks that are in charge of, you know, diabetes, you have the folks in charge of heart disease, and they're all wearing blinders, focusing on their own cause. Yet when we look at the risk factors that lead to these different conditions, they're all shared and they're all the same, but nobody seems to be working together. So you seem to have a very unique vantage point in the sense that you've worked with numerous types of institutions and organizations with very different types of skills. So how do we bring them together?
Rod, I think you have a better sense of the solution, where you actually bring it together at the workplace, where you don't have a choice, that you have to be human-centric around a person who will have diabetes, cardiovascular disease, they may have cancer, depression. But I'd say that two responses. The first time I saw this really thought about, strangely enough, was driven by Novo Nordisk when they supported the Oxford Health Alliance in the early 2002-2003 period. And I was privileged to be on the board with the then inspiring CEO, Lars Rebien Sørensen, Sir John Bell, who is at Oxford, the Regius Professor. And the Oxford Health Alliance brought together people to try and make progress on non-communicable diseases. And our mantra initially was 3-4-50. Three major risk factors, four major diseases. The risk factors at the time we listed were tobacco, diet, physical activity. Four major outcomes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, accounting for 50% of global mortality. And that 3-4-50 mantra showed that we were taking an integrated approach, recognizing the common risk factors affect so many diseases, as you know. It evolved over time, and you know, we can quibble whether it should be 4, 5, 75 or whatever it is. But the fact that we were thinking in an integrated way made it very different. Turning to what you're saying, the structure, though, of both WHO, health departments, universities, medical schools, medical departments, tends to be disease-specific, often ignoring the risks. And I think that is a huge concern, particularly now at a time when we're starting to look at how do we address two, in my mind, monster risks in the world, obesity and tobacco. And obesity, as you know, is the rates on the last Lancet survey showed increases everywhere in the world. Not a single country, not one country in the world, do we have an example of a decline in obesity. And rates now exceeding 40-45% across the Middle East, small island states, part of America, South Africa, and so on. Smoking, we have a lot more good examples, but still the numbers are well in excess of a billion people using products that are killing them. So the question is, how does the tobacco and obesity world integrate into cardiovascular disease or into cancers? We almost have separate reports coming out every day. The latest was yesterday. The American Cancer Society released their projections with IARC on cancer into the next few decades. And their comment was really, most of this is driven by aging of the population. They give scant attention to the fact that the underlying drivers, many of them, are tobacco, probably a third, diet, maybe 20-25%. And if we change those, you'll change the direction of the cancer incidence and mortality. Very little discussion because the folk in the cancer treatment world don't integrate enough with those in prevention. And I've seen that all over the world. I remember way back, even at WHO, going to a meeting on lung cancer in Austria. There were these huge lung cancer experts. There was virtually no topic, no one talking about smoking. It was all about interventional things, the latest in terms of therapy and treatment and surgery and so on. So that is a big problem. It came to a head for me because I would say, mea culpa, I'm as guilty of that in some of the ways I've thought about chronic diseases, until a colleague who worked with me at WHO, Amalia Waxman, today the head of sustainable development at Teva Pharmaceuticals, asked a group of us, myself, Kotha Hajat, a good colleague and friend of both of ours, and some folk at Mount Sinai, to do a report on the extent of multiple chronic diseases. How often did they occur together? What was the evidence on the number and the type of multiple of chronic diseases with age? What were the implications for pharmaceuticals, for the health service, for the healthcare provider, and for the patient? And we put together a report, and Kotha then went on to do a lot of peer review publications, which you can see online about this. And I think we were all shocked that we hadn't thought about this question. And the way you frame the fact that over the age of 40 or 45, 3, 4, 5 chronic diseases will occur in the same person. So it'll be natural that you will have hypertension and cardiovascular disease and other types of cardiovascular disease and be depressed, maybe have cancer. And the implications we saw were firstly that in terms of drug adherence, people were all on their individual drugs. Every time you add a new drug medication to a list, adherence goes down. And if you're at 4, 5, 6, 7 medications, adherence is starting to get really low. Secondly, diagnostics. There was overdiagnosis or underdiagnosis or misdiagnosis. And most importantly, the impact on the individual patient was one of confusion, bewilderment, unable to actually navigate a system which was set up for individual diseases in the era of an infectious disease paradigm, when today most people over the age of 40 or 50 will have some complex multiple chronic diseases. So I see this as one of the great challenges of my time. And to be personal, you know, I've been going through a series of cancer treatments and things, and just seeing how on the disease side, we have one set of problems, but the links to risks, which you're saying, is also not there. So when you're going through cancer treatment, very rarely do people say, what about your physical activity? Are you aware there's a massive literature showing that the more active you are, the lower your side effects and probably the increased your survival? What about diet? How do we actually frame the diet of somebody going through cancer to match the specific needs of a treatment regime, which can be quite brutal, and the underlying cancer? And then the third one, the whole issue of the spiritual dimension of health, where we know that the quality of your mental health state and how you're thinking about meaning and purpose has a material impact on your survival, your quality of life going forward. Putting this all together, I think if we put the person at the center of multiple chronic diseases, as opposed to being the subject of the treatments and things, I think we'll start building a very different type of system. How we do it, I'm not sure, but I genuinely do think that sitting in a workplace, you have an opportunity to do things differently because you've got a person, a whole person in an environment subject to all of these things and the potential to address the spiritual dimensions through the quality of the work environment in many different ways. The diet can often be controlled and improved. Physical activity can be actively promoted and you can have better screening. And of course, my past job at Vitality showed that this is not theoretically possible, but it is being done in many of the workplaces that Vitality is engaged in around the world, where their whole approach was to adopt 3-4-50 within their own numbers. And in fact, they also talk about it now in how they deliver services to people in an integrated way. Because from the personal point of view, people want to know about how's my overall health doing, not one particular disease. The employer wants to know what are the overall costs and the productivity gains, which again is an integrated approach rather than what's happening to cancer or mental health or individual diseases.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. Workplaces seem to be an excellent vehicle for integrating some of these solutions. But I wanted to go back to the risk factors associated with non-communicable diseases. And of course, your early work at WHO identified, you know, nutrition, healthy diet is one of the key pillars of the strategy. I'd be very curious to hear, you know, with that in mind, what your feeling was when you went from, you know, WHO setting the scene, setting the tempo when it came to giving guidance around nutrition for prevention, and then went to work for Pepsi. How was your experience, you know, walking in to Pepsi compared to, say, fast forward a few years later when you left the building?
I would say I've always had a sort of reflective view on how successful I can or can't be, and realize that in the end it's institutions, an individual can do what they can. But I would say I've came out with a sense that I was 65-70% successful. So for me, that was quite good. But I think what I gained, and I try to reflect back, you know, while we spoke about academia earlier, one thing that academia does is it documents, it reports, it writes, it puts into peer review publications, ideas. And that discipline is something I've carried in every single job I've had, which is usually unusual in the private sector. So when I was at PepsiCo, we kept publishing. And the reason I published was because I wanted my public health colleagues to understand the complexity of working in a private institution. I wanted them to know what are the constraints on how you address obesity without just shaking a finger at the industry and saying change, when these pesky consumers stick with their foods and products, or you have enormous constraints on the financial side to bring about change. And one of the most important things I think we achieved at PepsiCo as a team was to get the support of our bosses, Indra Nui and Mahmoud Khan, the head of science. And they really allowed us to map out a long-term vision of salt, sugar, fat, and where it should go over the next many years. Set those as the guidelines for R&D, for future product development, something that's basically still in place. And I saw that the impact of that was that the overall proportion of products being sold with full calorie, sugar, for example, have diminished quite dramatically. And they're now down well below 50% of the total volume of products. On some of the food side, we've seen the increase in stuff coming up. Remember that a company like PepsiCo, or any of the big food companies or pharmaceutical companies, their horizon isn't 1 or 2 years. It's 10 years plus. You think about planting new potato plantations or growing corn or growing chickpea, which are all products that go into the Pepsi portfolio. That takes 5, 10 years to do. Yet the mindset often in public health tends to be much shorter and thinking that you can bring about quick change. You can't. So to answer your question, did I feel happy? First, I was thrilled at Pepsi. I got a rich array of experiences. I learned stuff that people in public health could benefit enormously from, particularly the fact that a dedicated R&D team can actually make sustained progress at a really fast pace on practical things like lowering sugar, lowering salt, improving the quality of foods, and so on, in ways that I had no clue about. I also learned about taste and flavor, something we don't talk about. Underlying a lot of what we deal with in terms of the likability of food is things like mouthfeel and the taste and the flavor. And whereas today there are those saying that the companies are manipulating those to have people consume more, that may be partly true. But if you don't understand the importance of taste and flavor, you can't bring about healthier products. People will not eat cardboard, and they won't drink stuff that tastes like sand.
Yeah, that's very true. I remember speaking to the lead expert at a company called Firmenich. And for those not familiar, Firmenich is a New Jersey, Swiss and New Jersey based organization that probably not a lot of people have heard of, but they started in the business of perfumes, and they were behind some of the most famous perfumes in the world. And one day they realized that if you can figure out scent, you can pretty much dominate taste profiles as well. And so fast forward to today, they make some of the taste profiles of the biggest, you know, food companies around. And this neuroscientist that was heading sort of this work mentioned there was something called the flavor triangle, where you have sugar, fat, salt, and you have to stay in the lines of the triangle. And so if you reduce one, you have to increase another.
And that's a practical thing, right? I mean, yes, we worked with Firmenich. Givaudan was the other big one. Manel is the big US-based one. All groups, as you say, nobody thinks about. A colleague at Yale of mine, she's long retired, Linda Bartachuk, worked with the person who got the Nobel Prize for taste, Axel, from Colombia. And she used to really give us a lot of guidance about the individual toast profiles and the importance of this. And of course, these companies are now using flavorants and tastes and fragrances, not just in food. I mean, it's in all consumer goods, we're seeing it being used. Obviously, unfortunately, the alcohol industry is abusing them enormously in their sort of alcopops. We've seen it in the vaping sector. It's ubiquitous. And the reason is because we know increasingly the neurobiology and the neuroscience of taste and flavor, and where in the brain you actually store memories with certain flavors. I always remind people that if you ask people who were brought up having Johnson & Johnson baby shampoo, the mere mention of that gets them to trigger the memory in their brain of warm, fuzzy times because of the vanilla and all of the things in it. And yet in public health, we don't think about the importance of flavor and taste as being a way to actually ease people into healthier products, or in the smoking area, I'd say as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. Applies to smoking as well. And I definitely want to get into tobacco in a second. But before that, I wanted to ask if you wouldn't mind explaining the principle of constructive ambiguity.
Yeah, so that's great you picked that up. Yeah, it was many years ago. I remember I was in a conference in Salzburg, and somebody called Harlan Cleland, who'd been at the State Department in the Kennedy era. He was then in his late 80s and 90s. And we were talking about all the complexities in global health and how you deal with contradictions. And on the one hand, you want to promote infectious diseases, but the other you've got to do with chronic diseases or whatever it is. And so somebody said to him, "So what is the important lesson you've learned in international negotiations that we should be thinking about?" And he said, "It's this notion of constructive ambiguity, that you have to keep in your mind the fact that there are often two opposing ways to go forward, and not reject one or the other, but trying to balance them in a way in which you make progress." And that's something I've always tried to do and to think about. And it's often very tough because, particularly in the world today, we have such polarization where it's black or white when it's actually never black or white. It's always gray. We live in the gray zone. And I think when it comes to chronic diseases and people's lifestyles, I've written about the fact that the toughest part is to realize that the majority of the world actually lives in a gray zone between wanting to do what may be the most perfect in terms of health, but in reality, doing what is more realistic for them. So I'm sure many people would love to do their 10,000 steps a day, but they have enormous constraints. So they either give up, as opposed to being encouraged, like through a vitality program, do 2,000, do 3,000. We want to have a perfect diet, as if there is such a thing, but give up either because of price or access or the daily reality of life. So you go and have stock up on high sugar, salt, fat products. And that's also part of the constructive ambiguity at the individual level.
And on the concept of black and white and how it relates to, private sector in global health, I mean, you're someone whose career is a real Venn diagram of academia, international organizations, private sector. For somebody who's just starting out in global health and wants to save as, many lives as possible, would you still advise them to do it from inside, the belly of the beast, i.e., private sector?
Yeah, and I get asked that a lot, and and I love talking to students about it. I'm not the best person to give advice, but the recommendation I give to everybody is that's probably not the first question to think of. To my mind, the question is, if you really want to be in global health or health, what are the things you should be equipping yourself with in terms of knowledge, science, and basic skills, and then apply them wherever you go? And for me, I'm an unashamed supporter of epidemiology as being the distinguishing discipline of public health. And not epidemiology as it's often practiced as a sort of statistical pursuit, but epidemiology as a way of thinking about causes. You tease around what are the causes of X, Y, and Z, and then what are the interventions that truly make a difference? The more advanced you can actually get in understanding the critical way to appraise the literature on what causes and what prevents and what treats, those skills have enormous credibility inside a WHO. I found they had enormous credibility inside PepsiCo, in Vitality, where you're able to say, is this really working? Is it really effective? There are other disciplines. I would now add computer science, at least at a reasonable level, as an absolute requirement for people going into public health. And thirdly, a strong sense of bioethics and ethics, because those are the things that you often find at the table when decisions are made. In the private sector, the question is this really going to have a benefit? Well, on obesity, well, you need epidemiology. Is it something we should be doing? Well, that's an ethical issue afterwards. And how do we do it at scale? Well, that requires some computer science knowledge.
No, I couldn't agree more. And speaking of, skill sets, I've found that one particular area, having worked in private sector for for over 13 years and still having a toe in academia by teaching, I do see a difference in one particular skill or domain, which is that of communication. And it became even more apparent, you know, during the pandemic, on the importance of the right communication. And, you know, one example is we had all this evidence, but the ability to translate the science into the public domain and translate it into where it needed to be, which was, you know, policymaking, was simply not happening. And my real concern over the next, you know, couple of years is that one of the trends we're seeing is that the speed at which communication is being produced and the number of platforms available for the general public are increasing. And so people, especially young folks, are consuming more information more rapidly. And of course there's always the risk of consuming information that's false or misinformation. How can we make sure that we become more efficient in translating the science, and B, safeguard especially younger individuals against the wrong type of information?
Well, I think, and today, I mean, you're absolutely right, Rod. I mean, I think this whole question of misinformation and actively generated disinformation is undermining so much confidence and trust in public health, whether it's the whole debacles during COVID and vaccines, which has led to now a worldwide resurgence of doubt about vaccines and denial about vaccines. We could add into there, of course, climate change denial falls into the same camp. My own things about smoking fall into the same camp. And I think we're in a world where you've got a growing group of conspiracists who are being fed off stuff off the internet, who are also now linked to political parties, who are going to challenge what can be done from a policy point of view without a basis in science. And that goes back to my earlier point that having a strong background in methodology assessment, in things like epidemiology and understanding causes, is going to be, I think those people will be in greater demand to be able to judge whether it's good science or whether it's junk science. Too often, of course, 99% of the time, the media will focus on the results without ever looking at the underlying methods. And if they're faulty, there's no way out of it. I think the other problem we face, you know, in the days before we had social media and a lot of internet traffic, it was kind of simple. You know, you'd go to these big index books, look through the literature, you know, do a thing on what works and what doesn't work, put it out. And if it was found that a drug or some product didn't work, it would be retracted and it would be removed and nobody would do anything about it. Today, even if you have a retraction which shows that A does not cause B, the retraction has no value because it's once something is out there in the internet, it becomes part of the common story. And particularly the more conspiratorial the story, the more unlikely it is that it's ever going to be countered. And that is a real threat both to the policymakers, to the clinicians, and to the young students. And I'm hoping that in time, while AI is generating a lot of the negativity, I think there are ways of building stronger reviews of methods into what gets higher priority in people's feeds, in people's analyses. And I can see that actually being a very powerful use of AI for good.
Yes, no, that's a very good point. And essential that, you know, we get this right when it comes to AI, especially now that we're in the early days before it gets into much trickier waters. So speaking of misinformation, you and I have another slight tie. So I don't know if you remember this, but when you started to work for the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World, there was an Indian journalist writing for a journal in India, and somehow they had gotten a hand of around 350 individuals in global health that you had contacted. And they then took this mailing list, and this journalist wrote one-on-one to each individual, asking them, their thoughts on why you had gone to work for a tobacco company and so on. I didn't reply, but it was such a splash in the news because the individual who had started, the biggest anti-tobacco movement, who had spearheaded the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, laid all the groundwork, who had fought tobacco for years, of course, then went to work for an organization that many deemed to have, very direct ties to a large tobacco company. So, what do you think the next 10 years are going to look like in terms of scientists, academics, the global health community, taking a evidence-based approach when it comes to the science around certain issues rather than, immediately demonizing the concept of any work the private sector does, and along the same vein, looking at the science and the evidence behind things like harm reduction?
Yeah, no, thanks for that. I mean, my own journey was interesting because even when I left WHO, even when I was at WHO, people don't realize that that was an era when we invited tobacco industry scientists into the WHO building during the Framework Convention to answer the question, are you likely to be able to innovate your way out of this with better products? And this was 1998, 1999. And the answer was at that stage pretty iffy. So it was dropped. And that was the last time the industry was ever invited into WHO. So over the years, I kept looking at this. And when I left WHO, I wasn't involved tobacco directly for a while. And then about 7, 8 years ago, maybe a bit longer, I was asked by the editor of the Spectator Health in the UK. You know, Spectator's a bit of a stuffy magazine that reaches a sort of political class, but they had a fun health editor, and he said to me, "Derek, we're seeing a lot of stories about vapes and e-cigarettes. What's the story about them? Are they beneficial or not? What should we be thinking about?" And this was, I say, 8, 9 years ago, before it really took off. And I really used the chance to dig deep back into it and found that I'd missed the fact that, first of all, snus, which is the Swedish product, the evidence had got so strong and overwhelming and was explaining why the snus user in Sweden has had the lowest cancer rates in Europe by far, and that snus had displaced cigarettes, and today they're close to less than 5% of smoking among men, and accompanying that, as I say, the lowest cancer rates. Why did we miss that? Why did we not tell people that there's a tobacco product? Yes, it is tobacco derived, that is basically nicotine being absorbed. On the vape side, I was amazed at the explosion that was happening 8, 9 years ago across Europe and the UK. And who were using it? Yes, there were kids, there was some recreational use, but there were smokers looking for something that they sought to reduce their risk and get the enjoyment. And they knew that they got the enjoyment from nicotine. And so I wrote this up, not really thinking much about it. And when I was at Vitality, we did a few studies trying to look at it. And then I get a call from the head of Philip Morris, who said, "This is all very interesting. He'd like to talk about what they're doing," which was about to launch, or they just launched the heated tobacco product in Japan. "And they are betting the company's future on harm reduction." And of course, I didn't believe it, I was skeptical. But I went along. I met two or three times in their laboratories. I brought molecular biologists and scientists to, because I couldn't judge whether these machines were just very shiny and nice or whether they were really actually doing fundamental work. And what I found was several hundred pharmaceutical scientists, all coming out of the pharmaceutical industry, toxicologists, increasingly epidemiologists, and the same now at British American Tobacco, all basically charged with reducing the risks of the product and trying to get out of combustible cigarettes as fast as possible. Public debate around this was very different. It was, this is a trick, it's a gimmick, we can't trust them. Well, I won't go into too much detail, but yes, I suffered a bit of harassment and isolation and couldn't go back to WHO and all these things. But was it worth it? And where are we today, to get to your question? You know, there was a little film that came out recently about a woman called Mercedes Gleitz, who, I'm a swimmer, so I'm very interested in her. She was the first woman to swim the English Channel in the 1920s. And she then did a lot of swims in South Africa. But people didn't believe her. And so she had to go back into the water and redo the channel. And the film is called Vindication. And I always think it's such a perfect word for what I'm seeing today in this field of harm reduction. So let's just go from 7 or 8 years to where we are on a few things. 7 or 8 years ago, you had a couple of tens of millions of users of vapes, heated tobacco, nicotine pouches. Today, you've got almost 120 million people. Most of them are ex-smokers. We had no evidence 7, 8 years ago that we were going to see declines in adult smoking as people use this stuff. Well, today we know that the Japanese adult smoking rate has been cut by 50% in the last few years, not because of government policy, but because they've actually moved to heated tobacco products. Similar to low level is due to it was what's happening in Korea or Lithuania and Eastern Europe. E-cigarettes are driving the same phenomenon, particularly in countries like the UK, the US, New Zealand. And of course, snus has been driving it across Sweden, Iceland, and whatever. Put this all together, and it shows that we've got the largest mass consumer movement driven by technology, lowering risks among combustible cigarettes that we've ever seen, and at a rate far faster than I would ever hope to have achieved in the WHO Framework Convention. So that's the first. The second is, one of the curious things about the Framework Convention, where I think we either missed the boat or we just weren't thinking about it deeply, was that the word patent and intellectual property and innovation doesn't appear in any way in the text. Now, this is the same negotiating team from Brazil who were negotiating the Doha round, which addressed the issue of patent pricing, HIV/AIDS treatment, and getting access of drugs to people in developing countries. Why did we not think that there was some innovation or intellectual property issues that would come up? And the reason was because we said, well, this is a dirty old legacy industry. All we've got to do is bash the hell out of them. They'll go away. There's nothing they can do to innovate. That was 20 years ago. How wrong we were. If you look at the patent filings that have happened over the last 10, 15 years, the area of tobacco harm reduction products across all this whole spectrum, and not just the big companies, but the Chinese and the smaller companies, it's one of the fastest growing areas of patent filings in the European Patent Office, in the Chinese Patent Office, in the American Patent Office, showing that there's not just innovation and science, but there's clearly a business plan behind this. And if you watch the patent filings, you know what's going to happen on the street 5, 10 years later. And so what's happened on the street? Well, the first company to achieve half of their sales no longer from combustibles is Philip Morris International. The very company that supported the foundation and said they were going to do it a few years ago, they've done it. There's something like 25 countries in the world where half of the people are no longer using combustible cigarettes, but using the reduced risk products. And I know that BAT is fast catching up across maybe a wider spectrum because they have a broad base of vapes and pouches and heated tobacco products that are likely to also start having the same effect. Basically saying, I feel vindicated that the vision of why I hoped the foundation would make progress would happen while the companies were starting to make even greater progress is more than coming true. They're definitely on target. And the quality of science has gone up. I never thought I'd see the quality of biomarkers and exposure things. Remember, one of the biggest questions people keep asking is, well, what are the long-term effects of a vape or heated tobacco product and so on? Do they improve cessation? And the answer is now pretty clear cut. We know that the commonest way to quit completely is through a vape. We don't yet know about heated tobacco and nicotine pouch and other things. Maybe it'll be the same. But it is twice as effective as the nicotine replacement therapy. And none of these are industry reports. This is the Cochrane Collaborating Center, the world's best reviewer of randomized trials that keeps coming up and keeps upping the evidence, strengthening it. Just in the last couple of weeks, we had Nancy Rigotti writing in the New England Journal saying that we're probably approaching a tipping point where the time has come for physicians to be advising their patients who smoke that they should be trying vapes even before they try nicotine replacement therapy, given the hardcore evidence coming out of some of the bigger trials and the things that we've said. So the evidence of the benefit is growing. The evidence of the long-term benefit will take time, but the early use of proxies like measures of predictors of cancer and cardiovascular and many of these things that we now have more sophisticated markers on, biomarkers and pre-biomarkers, all are pointing in the right direction, suggesting to me that we don't have to wait for another Dole and keto study to follow doctors for 50 years. We can actually already have pretty good confidence today that these products, if they meet the criteria of the FDA, which has authorized a lot of them, actually will substantially lower their risk. And that's why it's just fortuitous that I have a piece in the Lancet as we speak, just making that very simple point that the time has come to really review the evidence. And I think the problem I've seen, while I feel vindicated, there's still a lot more work to do to convince my colleagues. And that's an issue I think about a lot, that it's clearly not the evidence that's going to get them to change. I don't know that we need substantially more to make the case these are truly life-saving products. I think we have to think in other realms. What is it going to take for somebody who doesn't believe in the vaccines to believe in the vaccines? What about the Flat Earth Society? Why do some people, genuine people, still believe the Earth is flat? Why do still some people deny climate change? And I think we need to look into the behavioral, cultural, social traits that make it difficult for some people to move from one set of a dogmatic view to another, even when the evidence has changed. And this is not an easy issue. I think we tend to go at it as a black-white issue again, saying you're stupid or you're dumb or you don't know what you're talking about. Most of these people are not stupid or dumb. They have an emotional reason. Some of the emotional reason is tied to the history of the tobacco industry. Anything coming out of the mouth of the tobacco industry today immediately triggers in your mind the lies they've told over the years and may still be telling. A lot of the deception that's happened over the years. Showing them the evidence may help, but asking them more carefully, what do you require to actually make a shift in your approach, I think is more useful. And that's something I'd love WHO to think about deeply, because if they actually open the door to say, let's take an open look at what we now have on the table compared to 20 years ago, let's do it from the perspective where the biggest question should be, how do we save the lives of the adult smoker of today? Of course, the issue of kids must be dealt with, but that should be the central question. I have no doubt that an open-minded group led by a relatively new chief scientific officer, Jeremy Farrar, who I think is one of our greatest scientists we have in the areas of global public health. You know, he led the Wellcome Trust for many years. A review led by him or his group may very well come to a conclusion that the evidence has now changed. And because the evidence has changed, we need to update our policy.
Do you think that if the University of Bath, one of the leading universities in the world for tobacco control, were to produce a vape with a Bath logo on it, it would change people's minds?
It's a great question, right? No, but you're close to an interesting point, because I do think that these issues, I mean, as I said, all of these people are very bright, and, you know, despite the critique I take, I respect most of them, not all of them. Last year, I think it was last year, a group of very thoughtful people led by Ken Warner, one of the greats in health economics and tobacco control, who was one of the early ones to accept the fact that harm reduction had massive benefit effects. But he was joined in a New England Journal article with Joanna Cohen, coming out of the Bloomberg School of Public Health, who's been one of the most vociferous opponents. And even, I think, Matt Myers was on it, and a group of other scientists. What were they writing about? They were writing about the whole need to have medically licensed vapes and harm reduction products. Now, there are many in public health, many in the harm reduction world who say that's terrible, it's going to destroy the recreational market. But I think if we listen to carefully what they're saying, we need a higher level of evidence. If you can meet a pharmaceutical or a medical bar, then we would put our stamp on it. And that goes to the point of, I'd be very surprised if Bath would actually not put their stamp on a product that went through the British MHRA as actually showing that it meets the criteria of any other thing on the medical license list. The problem has been that the tobacco industry hasn't been doing this very well, and neither has the pharmaceutical industry. So it's left to smaller groups of companies. But I think that is a very important way to go, because I've always felt that the moment you get that endorsement of the product, one of the products actually having a medically justifiable use, which must be pretty easy to do, it creates a halo for the doctors to then say, okay, now we can prescribe. Whereas at the moment, the pressure and the negativity in the media is so bad about the kids and popcorn lung and Ivali and a whole lot of nonsense that doesn't exist, that they're spooked into not willing to take the risk. So yes, your question about, I love the idea. Maybe you should speak to Anna Gilmore and see, well, why doesn't she go to the MHRA with a product and get an MHRA and stamp it with Bath? And I don't mind if she takes 50% of the royalty. Great. Then she could wear herself of Bloomberg. Yeah. They, of course, sit with the grant of $20 million, the Stop campaign funded by Bloomberg, which lists all of us terrible people who have any association with industry. And I'm not sure. I've always felt it's a bit of a waste of money, because there's nothing I've done which isn't transparent, and I'd be happy to send her the stuff free.
I found it so interesting that you mentioned that academics and folks in global health have harassed you stronger and more viciously than when you were on the other side of the fence and were critiquing the food industry and tobacco industry. Are you still in contact with people from the global health world and people at WHO?
Yeah, you know, I have always, whenever I've moved, despite what the official thing is, I've always kept personal contacts. I've always kept relationships. And people talk to me. Some are in deep angst. They know that, I know that there are many very senior people at WHO who know very clearly that this harm reduction train is real. It's moving. The Lancet recently put out major pieces in their editorials, written by two of the ex-directors who I worked with, Ruth Benita and Robert Beaglehall, you probably know, two highly respected people. When they say the time's come for harm reduction, it must have come. Yes, I speak to people even inside some of the Bloomberg world, where remember that Bloomberg Philanthropies has a huge harm reduction program separate from tobacco. It's about drug abuse and decriminalization and methadone and needle exchanges. And if you speak to them privately, they will say there's no difference philosophically between what they're doing and what we want to do in harm reduction. It's that ideological difference that is actually blocking them taking a truly integrated approach. So all that means, you know, I think one has to keep every door open always, because through dialogue, eventually, I'm pretty convinced that we will actually get the breakthroughs we need.
I also keep in touch with a few folks at WHO, and one person in particular I remember speaking to was Leanne Riley.
Yeah.
And she said, you were one of the best bosses she ever had. She said you would push her to places that she never thought she could take herself, and she would realize she would produce these amazing results with that guidance of yours. And yeah, that's stuck with me for a while.
That's nice to know. But it's funny you mentioned Leanne because she is one of the authors of this report that came out in The Lancet on the global trends in obesity. And kudos to her for sticking to it. It's probably the most magnificent report that we've ever seen on trends in obesity and underweight. It's a combined thing with WHO at its absolute best, a huge global team, basically putting the science on the table, or whatever it shows, not delving into what are the intimate policy things, which are more complex. And that's been her forte, is to get the science and the evidence out. And there are others that WHO do. I think the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation, Chris Murray and his team out in Seattle, thank God for them, because they produce these extraordinary reports that most people in public health are not studying, not just about tobacco and diet, but what's working and what isn't working. And so I think we have got some, you know, we've got great resources. It's this gap between using the data that is staring us in the face and applying it.
I read your book, by the way, Project Unthinkable, A Doctor's Gamble to Save Millions of Lives. And I found it fascinating. I really enjoyed it. And one of the chapters that I really liked was when you were talking about applying for a US visa work permit, and you had to list two references, and you listed two other juggernauts in the global health world, Pekka Puska, who I had the privilege of working with, and Julio Frank, who used to be the Minister of Health of Mexico.
Yeah, Julio, by the way, I don't think you'd mind me saying it. He's very supportive of harm reduction. And he tells this extraordinary story when he went to Harvard. And he was a smoker in those years. And they kept telling him, you can't smoke, and telling him to ban it. And he said, I'm not going to listen to you. I'll decide in my own time, my own place. And years later, he did quit. And he told me very interesting things. So I said, how do you classify yourself? He said, I'm a smoker who's not smoking. And that shows, again, the complexity that we don't think that people go through these real struggles. And that means that there's always need to give support to people. And that sort of sense of empathy, which you had a lot of, was great. Anyway.
I've kept you long enough, but thanks so much for that. That was fantastic. And I really enjoyed our conversation today.
No, real privilege to see you.
Hey, thanks for listening, folks. If you enjoyed that, please hit subscribe, like, and share. See you next time.